Hey, Will.
Hey, Ryan.
How you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. We're into February now. January just flew by.
Yeah. It goes quickly. But some good news is we've got the Six Nations, so there's plenty of things to be keeping busy with. Are you a rugby fan?
Not really, but I do have something else I'm excited for in February, which is a game called Horizon.
Okay.
Horizon. So the first... game was called Horizon Zero Dawn. So it's coming out on PlayStation. If you'd like to order a copy.
You're trying to set up a partnership.
Yeah, I wish. No, I just really want this game. The second game or sequel is coming out later this month. This is just a scenario where I'm just spending a whole weekend playing that. Yeah, really cool story. It's about... Well, there's robots. There's robotic dinosaurs in the future.
Mm-hmm. I did see the release of the first one, but it's not actually something I ever managed to get around to playing. It sounds like it's a good game.
It's an amazing game. But we should probably do an episode on that at some point.
Yeah.
But today we have a slightly less exciting and crazy topic, which is school references.
Yeah. Definitely. I think it's something which. You know, we were saying we don't talk about too much.
No.
But I think it's still definitely an area of concern for sort of students and parents, because it's just another thing that they don't want to get wrong, right?
And, you know, I think a lot of the time we talk about Oxbridge in particular, but the school reference is even more important for those universities.
Yeah.
I think sometimes people don't realize how important it is.
Yeah.
Because loads of students spend huge amounts of time on their personal statement, and there's just so many textbooks and school teachers that are like really good at helping with personal statement, but no one really talks about the school reference yet. That carries more weight.
Well, I suspect it's probably just because as the applicant, there's not really much you can do about it aside from make sure that your school does it.
Yeah.
Normally schools sort of like to take it on themselves. And I mean, so when I was applying, I didn't really have any involvement on that side of things. I think the only time when that's different is if you are an international student and you go to a school that isn't, you know, a school in the UK, so hasn't done UK university reference letters. And in that scenario, they'd probably say, well, what are we supposed to put here? Because we don't know.
Yeah. But do you think that it is true that, because you know, when I was applying, there was kind of like this, on the grapevine, it was that if you went to a really, really nice school, the school would write your personal statement and you'd essentially write the school's reference.
Oh, wow.
I mean, not officially, of course, but you know, that's kind of how things ended up being in practice. Like the school would like, give you so much help that in practice they were essentially writing your personal statement.
Right.
Your parents, if you had like pushy parents, would kind of... demand to see the school references and suggesting in air quotes amendments to it.
No, so I don't think I ever actually saw my school the reference from my school whilst I was applying. Maybe at other schools, but not at mine. It was just something that they did and you hoped it was nice. But I don't know why a school wouldn't write a good reference, right?
Yeah, so when I was at school, my teachers would often say something like, we'll always be really honest in our references to you, because if we recommend you unreservedly to the university, then, and actually you're not very good or you set a bad example, then it makes our future references look really bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, removes all credibility. But I think, I don't actually know if anyone got a bad reference.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it'd be shooting themselves in the foot, right? Like,
yeah, because obviously the school wants you to do well. You know, they want as many of their students, hopefully, if it's a nice school with good teachers, they want their students to get into good universities. And, you know, yes, they'd need to sort of pair it with a bit of realism. You know, if you've got very bad grades at GCSEs, they can't be saying he's a sort of academic genius, that kind of thing. But you could definitely say things like how engaged you are in class, how you sort of contribute to discussions, how you sort of tackle material, how you sort of do homework on time, that kind of thing. And I don't think the university would ever be able to say, or ever sort of say, well, we think that you lied about that, so we're not going to pay attention later. I don't know. It seems like maybe it's something which the universities say to the schools to sort of make the school references more credible, but they wouldn't actually, I don't think they'd actually do anything about it.
Yeah, they'd be a lot of work, wouldn't it, for them to kind of follow up and kind of manage that whole process from start to finish.
Yeah, you'd have to sort of the thousands of reference letters that universities get, whoever's evaluating them would have to sort of recognize, oh, actually, and then sort of follow up with the student in a few months' time. I don't know, it seems implausible to me.
Yeah, and it'd be a prospective follow-up over presumably a fairly long period of time. And
yeah,
people can obviously change as well. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah,
I mean, how do you think it compares with like employer references? Because like that, I mean, whenever someone applies to a job, often they'll get asked for referees.
Yeah. So I think, one way to look at it is also not quite employer references, but for like when you ask for academic references, if you apply for postgraduate stuff.
Okay.
At that point, the references become really important. And it is important for the undergraduate, but I think they become more important the further on you go. And I think for when you sort of are applying for a job as well, it becomes, I would say that references become even more important. You know, we sort of compare the personal statement and the school reference in terms of importance. But if you think about writing a CV and getting a employment reference, I would say that the employment reference is way more important than the CV. I don't know if you view it the same way.
Yeah, I guess they're just less, I suppose there's more litigation involved in jobs and workforce selection than there is in university selection. I've not really heard of a case where if a student didn't get a place, they'd sue the university. Whereas that does happen sometimes in like employment practices. So for instance, and legally, I think now the employer, all they have to do is just confirm the employment date and the job title rather than kind of like this person was really good, this person was really bad, or because then there's risks associated with that.
So do you think, are you saying that because of that, it makes the reference like less useful?
Yeah. And I think it's more of like a verification rather than what I think they're originally intended for, which is just like a subjective second opinion.
Yeah.
By someone who's actually worked with them. Because often, negative references I think are quite rare like throughout, but I think references, it's more common to just refuse references. I don't think I've ever.
But that in itself is telling, right? If someone refuses to write a reference.
But they won't, as in typically the order of sequence of events is you'll go to whoever you want to be your referee, ask them, will you be my referee?
Yeah.
And then put down their details and then they get contacted. Like that's essentially the way someone should do it.
Yeah.
I suppose if they've not done it that way, they've just given the details down and then the referee gets a call and they say, actually, I refuse to give a negative. I don't want to give a reference. And that's, as you said, very telling.
Yeah.
I think that's unlikely, right? Like why would someone agree to?
And why would you go to them if you know that, you know, if you've worked in a place or you were at a uni and you had a relationship with a boss or a supervisor and it wasn't a good one?
Yeah.
Exactly. Why would you pick them to give your reference?
And I suppose the candidate or the applicant knows that, but the referencer, the university or in this case an employer, wouldn't know that. They wouldn't know that, for instance, 10 people had turned down a reference, they didn't want to touch this guy. All they would see is just, okay, here is the number I've got to call. So there's a huge selection bias, essentially, or a disparity of information.
So do you know can schools give negative references then? Or are they bound by similar rules of you have to just be neutral or positive?
So I think even in employment, you can give negative references. It's just people choose to be factual. So everything you say has to be factual. So for instance, you can't say this employee was bad. You have to say something like, this employee did not turn up to time 50%.
Yeah.
For instance, which is defendable. Because I think the risk is, in theory, I don't really know too much about this, but I think in theory, you could get sued for defamation.
Mm.
I don't know if the schools would be held to that level of, I mean, it stands to reason that they would, but it's not simply employment, it's an appointment, which tends to have different rules associated.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess for the reason why they've made the system such that people can't just be overly defamatory about you, you could see the same reasoning could apply to the school environment.
If you have like a really bad teacher who just doesn't have a very bad chemistry with.
Yeah. You know, you don't want that to then have a really bad long-term impact.
I find it interesting that you didn't know your school reference. I mean, obviously you got it, so it didn't matter, but or it did matter clearly. But what I suppose I'm saying is it could have been a terrible reference.
It could have been.
And you didn't know. I mean, I got to read my reference. And actually, my teacher was pretty good. She kind of went through and said, are there any, quotes, suggestions that you have for this?
Okay, yeah.
And, we changed, there was nothing major we changed. We just changed a couple of lines around. But in your case, you were kind of going in blind almost.
Yeah. I mean, I don't recall being involved in it, unless I've misremembered pretty horrendously. I think, it was, I did actually have a look at it further a few years later. I found it and sort of read it. But I think there was the trust that, well, I was doing well in class, right? So, you know, I'd been doing well in my subjects. Mm. And, you know, getting on well in class. So I guess I wasn't going to assume that it was being a negative reference. I also knew that the school was quite keen on students getting into university. So I thought they'll probably want to give me a positive one anyway.
What about that teacher who...
I don't think she wrote my reference. Because we had... we'd have... For each A-level subject, we had two teachers.
Okay.
And it was, and basically I think it was there was a guy, a male teacher and a female teacher who taught me for psychology. And I think it was the male teacher who ended up writing my reference. Okay. I mean, you know, my history teachers, I think sort of were fans of me. My maths teachers, I think, were enough of a fan of me for it to work. I guess that gave you a bit of a safety net, right? If one teacher doesn't like you, then they just don't write your reference and the other one does. It's very sensible.
Yeah, I was trying to think what happened with... So I think for me, I was doing five A-levels or something, so every single one of my subjects. So the school system was actually quite good. So they would have like a generic paragraph at the start saying, King Ed's school does this, has this many students,
etc.
And then they had like a paragraph from each of the teachers who taught you. Mm-hmm. So I had like five paragraphs, like short ones. And then your form tutor, who was like in charge of it, would kind of synthesize it all into one together.
Yeah, so it wasn't dissimilar. I think instead of form tutor, it was the head of sixth form wrote like that summary thing. I mean, I guess now's probably a good time, actually, for people who are listening and who don't go to school in the UK, their school might be saying, well, what should we be doing? They might be thinking, what should we be doing? Now's probably a good time to sort of, in a bit more detail, go through what to put on that reference letter. Because naturally, you know, we've said that in your case, you saw it. In my case, I didn't. But either way, it's still something which universities are going to be using to evaluate.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that's a good point. Internationally, I mean, it's so obvious to us in the UK what it should look like.
Yeah.
But internationally, it's a completely different story, right? They may have not even ever had a student applying to the UK. English may not even be the first language for the school, for instance. So there's all sorts of barriers. So I guess we come at it as a, what should the universities, what would they like to see? I suppose if I was an admissions tutor, it'd be helpful to have a level of background about the school. You know, I think a lot of school references start that way.
Yeah.
And then what else, you know, should other kind of key components? Is it, particularly if you're applying for some of the more competitive universities in the UK, how do you make the candidate stand out?
So I think one of the key things that you want to be reiterating on that reference is, you know, if this is true, sort of the student's enthusiasm and engagement with their subject in and outside of the classroom. You know, when I did eventually read my reference, there were lots of things sort of talking about.
You did read it in the end. Interesting.
Yeah, so I did pore over it at some point. I found it in one of my old drawers, and I sort of picked it up and had a look through. But it wasn't something that I was too bothered about at the time. But, you know, things like Will is really engaged in class, always brings, you know, ideas to discussions with other students, that kind of thing. Will's been particularly good at X or Y sort of module. He's, you know, really doing well with the mechanics or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So those kind of things, which, you know, beyond just I'm getting A stars or I'm getting A stars in my subjects, it actually gives a sense of what you are like as a student and how you are involved in your subject.
I remember seeing my reference for the first time, and there was the second paragraph started with Rohan came second out of his whole year in physics. And I was like, take that out. I don't want them to know. And my school teacher was really confused. She was like, the second is really good. I was like, no, it's not. I think I like got a big strop about that.
Okay. Did they take it out in the end?
No, I think they convinced me that second out of 300 wasn't...
Is good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
So essentially it's a holistic... And I suppose it's important to give context, right, in the statement, it's in the references, because something like, you know, in my case, came second, it could be a good thing. I mean, in this case, it clearly was, but it could also be a bad thing. Like second out of two students isn't great, for instance.
Yeah.
So this is just like contextual markers of achievement. And if you're going to like a really top achieving school, then I think it's important they say that. So students from our, you know, school go on to, or 90% of students go on to further education. 30% of these go on to the US, including 10% to Oxford. And like those kind of numbers, I think, really help set the scene of the quality of the competition and the support available to the student.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, we're a local comprehensive, class sizes are like 35 students, one teacher. Most of our students, 90% in free school. Like, again, just sets a very different tone, and it allows you to kind of, I suppose, contextualizes and humanizes that application more.
But they will, I mean, so certainly for Cambridge at least, they will have all that information, right? They'll get things like class sizes and things like that. They'll know quite a lot about the school, won't they?
Yeah, they will. But, well, firstly, the other universities wouldn't, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
Your alma mater, your Oxford wouldn't.
No.
Still don't quite get why Oxford doesn't ask for this form and Cambridge doesn't.
Yeah, I know. But so in which case, so yes, so certain universities don't, but could there be an argument then that maybe a reference letter for Cambridge,
yeah,
you know, you can save some space by not putting as much school oriented information and spend more time talking about the student?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, there's a 4,000 character limit. It's identical to the UCAS statement. What they say, I suppose, has to be used economically. But I mean, that's a fair amount of words. Do you think, as in essentially you're suggesting, the contextualization stuff can be, because my worry with it would be that information entered into the SAQ will almost be analyzed by a computer rather than a human at that level of information. It was going to a spreadsheet and then, you know, spit out a social score of whatever they would be calling now. Whereas, like, if it's a human reading the reference, they'll give them like that context.
I suppose, and I suppose, you know, there is a, I guess there's a question of how they really do, because when they talk about evaluating things all together, how they actually do that.
Yeah.
Because it could be, right, that there's a scenario whereby there's a period where they read through all the reference letters and score them, you know, out of 100, this reference letter was a 99 out of 100, this one was a 52.
Yeah.
Then they go through all the personal statements and rank those. Then they obviously have the admission test score, and then they rank your interview performance as well. And then when they're actually evaluating you as a whole, they might not actually look at the individual things themselves. They just look at these ranked scores.
Yeah, I think that's precisely how it works. And pretty much, I think definitely at Cambridge, less so at Oxford. But I think Oxford will just interview people based on their final score, and then the interview is like the determining factor.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one thing to say as well, which I think, because when I've spoken to people, international students, one of the things that schools aren't sure about, it's normally very similar concerns to what people have about the personal statements. Or often any mistakes that are made are often very similar to the kind of things that happen on the personal statements. So, you know, schools might spend a lot of time talking about students' non-academic sort of pastimes, things like that. And, you know, just to be really clear, that's not really what you want to be spending that space talking about. You know, you want to be, as in your case, talking about sort of academic achievements, so second best in the physics in the whole year, or talking about,
second best. Ugh.
Silver's nice, I guess. But
best the worst, second the best. That's how I cheered myself up. Yeah, all those years ago.
That helps you sleep. Helps stop the crying.
Yeah, but actually, now, thinking back to the other thing, which the school reference is kind of essential for, is extenuating circumstances.
Right? Sure.
So, if you've not done particularly well in your GCSEs, if you've had a family bereavement, if there's been some other personal issues. You know, if you didn't do well in your GCSEs because you took them all in 1 year, or you moved schools, or someone passed away, or also, you know, there's huge reasons. Personal statements aren't. I think it's fine to allude to them, but I think it has more meaning and weight coming from a school, because if I just, you know, if I say to you, well, I didn't get first in my exam because, you know, my dog died, it just sounds like an excuse.
Whereas
I think if it's coming from the school, and it's just slightly more neutral and more credible, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think actually in terms of extenuating circumstances, now in the sort of templates that they give, they specify that they want the school to talk about in whatever way COVID will have affected that individual's teaching. So you're absolutely right. They're looking for, in the school reference specifically, to give any reasons why there were anything sort of jeopardizing your education so far. And yeah, that's definitely a much better thing than to, you know, talk about in your personal statement. It, you know, like you said, you can allude to it. So you could say, for example, having spent a lot of my childhood in hospital, I was, you know, inspired. So they'll get that sense, but you don't want to be saying, I missed, you know, X 3 years of time at school. I think you're right. It's better to go in the reference there.
And I guess that's a good point in general, which is your reference should kind of complement personal statement rather than just kind of repeat it or give like a detailed summary of all your grades. Like it's because they already have all that. So that those spaces, those white spaces, are already there to kind of tell the universities why they should pick you. That's not already available. So there's no point saying, things like I believe I'm really well qualified to study physics because I'm studying physics, maths, and further maths. And I think this makes me a very calculating, analytical person. Like, that's just obvious.
Yeah.
It just doesn't add much, I suppose.
Yeah. So how, I guess your advice would probably be to sort of make sure that the school gives you a or lets you look at your reference, not only so that you can sort of say if there's anything that you're not too keen on, but also maybe so that you can maybe talk about certain things that they talk about in the personal statement.
Yeah, I think that's important, right? Because otherwise it's just a huge... And in some cases, repetition is good if it's like a really, really important point.
Yeah.
For instance, like you don't want that to kind of just get lost in a 8,000-word document.
Yeah.
So for instance, if it's something pivotal to your application, I don't know, let's say you won the International Mathematics Olympiad that's held across the world and you're applying for physics.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. Like it needs to come out. But if it's just... Yeah. You've done some work, got a relatively standard medical applicant. You've done some work experience. You've done a bit of extra reading. Like there's nothing huge, game changing. Then, yeah, it'd be nice to kind of have all bases covered. I suppose, just thinking of it, there is a risk that you spread yourself too thin. I mean, it's often when one goes to interview, it's very reasonable to get asked questions on your personal statement.
Yeah.
But presumably, it's fair
game reference.
To ask you questions about your reference. But, I mean, in my case, it would have been very fair because I've seen it. But in your case, it would have been unfair, especially if there was something negative on it.
So it says here that you're actually, you know, not really that interested in your subjects. That would be a bit of a...
You live in Cambridge or something like
that. Yeah, I mean, I don't... So, yes, absolutely, you can get asked about your personal statement. And I was asked a lot, actually. And that's why I always recommend people reread it before they go to the interview, because I didn't do that. And so they were sort of brought up stuff that I'd kind of forgotten that I'd talked about. Yeah. But I...
It's miraculous you're here, really.
Like, yeah. But I don't think... I have never heard of anyone being asked about stuff from their reference. And I also wouldn't have thought Oxford or Cambridge would be that interested in, because again, you know, if there is something spectacular that they want to talk about that's in your reference, you've probably talked about it in your personal statement as well, right? Yeah. They're not going to say, well, it says here that your maths teacher says you're, you know, very good at maths. That's not a very good sort of starting off point for an academic discussion.
Yeah. Yes, I don't know what... Because they wouldn't really ask about extenuating circumstances, because it's just, I suppose it's just not that. I probably wouldn't want to, you know, if I'd had a rough childhood, I probably wouldn't want to tell it to a randomer either.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, when they do use that kind of stuff as a springboard for the interviews, I think they want to sort of challenge you academically a bit and sort of put you through your paces a bit. So I kind of think the only thing they could really use is the personal statement. But, you know, that doesn't mean that you don't want the reference to be important, you know, or be well written. The thing that I'm thinking of now is the sort of marking criteria that we saw of the Oxford PPE admissions tutors, where they sort of rank the importance of all the different things that they look at. And the most surprising thing for me in there, a lot of it was stuff that I was expecting, you know, admissions test, pretty much the most important thing. So that makes sense. But then when I saw that the academic reference, the school reference, was more important than the personal statement, that was a real surprise to me. I hadn't anticipated that would be the case. But it would be interesting. I mean, do you think other universities, you know, University of Bristol, Sheffield, Lancaster, wherever, do you think the school reference is more important than the personal statement or less?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's interesting that at any university, the school reference is worth more than the personal statement.
Oh, yeah.
And I just wonder if it is that case, why it is that way. And I suppose it's just that being cynical, it's easier to lie on your personal statement. Whereas a school would be generally, you know, you'd hope, very reluctant to even stretch the truth.
Mm.
And therefore, one could argue that the reference is more indicative of actual performance versus what the performance is meant to be, right?
Yeah.
by which then it'd be fair for the other universities to say that actually we'll look at the school reference equally, if not more seriously than the personal statement. I suppose also the school references, it's not an indication of your ability, it's an indication of the school's ability to express and represent you, and that will be different. Whereas, because you know, they're not getting, when a student from a particular school gets a place at Bristol, for instance, Bristol University aren't getting that school, they're getting that applicant.
Yeah.
And that applicant, the biggest influence they have is on their personal statement. So I think it'd be unfair for them to kind of weigh the reference. I suppose if I was an admissions tutor, what I'd be doing is I'd be like screening the references for any red flags.
Yeah.
And then the red flags would either have to be discussed to interview or get rejected. But then you look at the personal statement instead. So it's almost like a binary yes, no check.
Yeah. But it is interesting, right? It's probably that relationship of how the school reference can be seen as more important than the personal statement. Mm. That is something that I can't really consolidate in terms of what I would have thought would matter most to them. Mm. You know, yes, you could say, well, maybe the school's a bit more reliable, but ultimately, you know that the school will have also seen the personal statement, so they probably will have also stopped the student from lying on that potentially.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's probably part of the application that I understand the least. If I'm being honest, I feel like the admissions test, that makes sense. Interviews, that makes sense. Yeah. Personal statement makes sense. But why on earth is the reference sort of treated this way? I don't know.
I guess particularly for, you know, top tier universities, they almost ignore the personal statement because it's just so subjective. Yeah. And it's a bit odd because, you know, the personal statement is very unstructured, right? Like, there is a follow-up formula that we recommend students to sit to kind of continue, but there's nothing holding them to that. They could, if they really wanted, they could write a poem about, they could write a sonnet about their experiences and why they should be getting a place to study at the university.
Yeah.
Perhaps for English, it may well be worth doing that, for instance.
Yeah, actually, you know, I would be quite keen to see sort of the most creative
personal
statements. I imagine there are some really creative ones out there. We both went for sort of, I guess, more sciencey things. Mine was not creative at all. It was just sort of prose about things that I've been doing. But yeah, for someone who's doing English or art, something like that, it makes sense to be really creative with it.
I sold my personal statement. It was that good.
You sold it?
I sold it, yeah. Which is I sold it when I was in a, so I got into Cambridge, and then in my first term, I got this email from can't say because I'm not meant to, but I got this email from a company and they were like, we'll buy your personal statement for 20 quid. And I was like, wow, 20 quid, that's a bargain. There you go.
How interesting. That's got to be frowned upon, Rohan, that kind of behavior.
Yeah. Well, it's your IP, right? Like, you can sign up. There's nothing stopping you from doing that. But ironically now, that personal statement is in a book that then directly competes with one I've written a few years ago.
Does that mean you can't use your personal statement in your books? Damn.
Well, to be fair, I can't find this contract, but just to be safe, and because it was good, but it wasn't like life-changing good. So.
Yeah. Okay. But I mean, so you say it's your own intellectual project. This is a bit of an aside. I feel like we've, you know, talked about the importance of references and things like that, but you say that it's your own IP, but, and this is one of the things that I've noticed Southampton are quite worried about or quite keen on stamping out, is the like selling your essays, your university essays, to these companies who then sort of, you know, offer essay writing for the next cohort of students.
It's 20 quid, yeah.
But but you can get in trouble for selling your stuff. Even though you're not the one sort of cheating, in terms of you're not the one paying someone else to do your essays for you, but because you're involved in that cycle and because you're supplying that cycle, basically, you can get in trouble for doing that. I would be surprised if you nowadays wouldn't get in trouble for selling your personal statement.
Interesting. I mean, people do still now.
Oh, I mean, yeah, people do. It's a pretty I think the police are probably busy enough as is. You know, they've got bigger fish to fry than all those personal statement sellers.
Yeah, intellectual property. I don't know what law would cover that. It feels like it's just more like an honor thing.
Yeah.
Rather than like a particular, I mean, it's definitely, it's not going to be criminal.
But I suppose like the university could decide to do something about it, right?
Yeah, sure. So, but it's not going to be a civil court matter. It's just a, if you were caught, then the university could have a policy, and if you breach that policy, then
yeah. You've breached their application T's and C's.
I don't think a court would like be able to. Yeah, I don't think you'd get convicted of anything that I can think of.
No.
But yeah, it's the ethical principle of feeding an ecosystem, which I get. No, very, very interesting.
No, yeah. I've been approached by people offering to write my essays for me, and I said, no, that's okay, I'm all right, thank you. I don't understand it. Why pay to go to university if you don't want to do it?
Yeah, I got approached when I was, this was a long time ago, I was doing my dissertation on the role of this, you know, role of X and Y, as all these dissertations in sciences tend to be. And then there was this company, like, essentially, I don't know quite now they've got my details, but they cold called me and they were offering to write my dissertation in a week's time and guarantee a first. And I was like, well, you know far less about this than I do. I just don't, and I can't do it in 1 week, let alone guaranteeing it. I managed to get one somehow, but you know, I was just astounded that this kind of business exists.
Yeah. Hey.
Wow. Okay. Coming back to references, there's lots of books and resources and materials on how to write good personal statements, but there's very few resources on how to write a good UCAS reference. I mean, we provide our students with kind of templates and letters of,
you know,
etc. So there's some structure to it, but it is pretty open, isn't it? I mean, there's limited guidance available to schools.
So UCAS does, you know, UCAS does have a page similar to what they have for personal statement, sort of outlying structure and kind of things to talk about. And, you know, that they talk about some of the things that we've talked about. But I you're right. There's nothing giving very specific advice. I think if I were a teacher having to write a sort of UCAS university reference for the first time, I'd be quite, not anxious, but I'd have sort of in the back of my mind the, you know, I've got to make sure that I'm doing this properly. I don't want to get it wrong. And so I imagine actually in UK schools, there's probably sort of teacher training to do that.
Yeah.
Certainly. For the first
one. I mean, on Amazon, there's no books about how to write a UCAS personal statement, a UCAS reference, for instance.
Yeah.
So there's a great disparity, I suppose, between. Because I suppose if you're in Turkmenistan or Kazakhstan and your students are applying for 10 different countries,
yeah,
it's going to be quite a big job to keep on top of like the requirements for each. Because that's just a huge amount of work, right?
Turkmenistan is an interesting random country example that you went for there.
Yeah, well,
you know they.
Yeah, they. It's called a frontier market, I think, rather than an emerging market. we actually had a student from Turkmenistan last year, one from Kazakhstan. So.
And I hope that their teachers were supported with writing that school reference.
Yeah, I hope so too. I think they came to us quite late, in fairness. So.
Okay, might have missed that deadline.
Yeah, I think that.
Well, I mean, is there anything else that you feel like we haven't covered, or do you think
I guess even a basic thing, like let's say you're applying in unusual circumstances. So you've graduated or you didn't get in, or you've left school, but you're applying as like a late applicant or a mature applicant.
Okay, yeah.
Who does your reference then?
So it will depend on sort of how mature you are. If you're like a reapplicant or something like that, you know, a couple of years out of school, normally it's just your school that will write that reference.
Mm.
If you're that much older though, you know, if you've been working professionally for a while and that kind of thing, you could have an employer write that reference. The rules, there's no rules saying it has to have been like a secondary school teacher or a secondary school head of sixth form to write it. And it could even be, you know, if you have a, someone once asked if they should get their piano teacher, asked me if they should get their piano teacher to write their reference. It was for music. I mean, what you want is just to have the most relevant person who's going to be able to give the best account of what you can do, right?
Who's someone who's at arm's length or like not relative. So
he's not allowed to be a family member.
Yeah, it can't be a family member. It can't be a partner. It can't be an ex-partner. It can't even be your friend in theory. I think that just needs to be. And the last thing you want to do is to write a really good reference, and then the university finds out actually it's not a credible source, in which case. Yeah.
But that's the same thing with all references, right? If you're applying for a particular job, you'd want the referees that you give to be people who have sort of seen you in that kind of environment.
Yeah.
If you're changing it, well, if you want to change industry completely, that makes it a bit harder because you might not have had someone who's able to say, actually, they're going to be really good at X. But if you're moving into a similar thing, then you want to have that. And I think similarly for academic references at the postgraduate level, you kind of want someone who's really, really relevant to what you're applying for. So if you're applying for a PhD in sort of chemistry or whatever it is, you want your referees to have sort of maybe been your chemistry tutor or supervised you in a project to do with chemistry. Mm. You can see I don't really know too much about chemistry by the fact that I can't get specific examples.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so I suppose to start wrapping up, we've kind of established that the UCAS references is an underrated tool in your arsenal when applying to university, and we've talked a little bit about who should be writing it and what should go in it.
Hmm.
Are there any things they definitely shouldn't mention?
Well, I mean, probably anything extreme.
Yeah. So I suppose like things that schools might consider including just for kind of completeness would be things like attendance records or like a complete transcript of all your results, like internal tests, which just may not paint things.
You don't need to do that.
We want it to be essentially whitewashed, don't we, the school reference. Like it just shouldn't really portray any massive weaknesses.
Yeah, I think talk about strengths, definitely. I mean, again, so, you know, for people applying to the States, there's always a tendency in these kind of things to talk about non-academic stuff. And I think that's the key thing to think, you know, your personal statement and your school reference should be at least 90% academic-y things. If you're talking too much about what an incredible weightlifter you are, it's just not what they're interested in.
Yeah, I think broadly the school reference just needs to be used more tactfully than the personal statement, which I think universities almost know and expect what the format of that personal statement is going to be, whereas they've got more creative license, I suppose.
Yeah.
That's the one, it's just not ignored. So. And if you're applying internationally, please make sure you definitely read your reference before you walk into your interview. And if your teachers tell you we don't do that, then just say it's common practice in the UK, and hopefully they'll show you.
Yeah, I'd have thought they'd be more than happy to sort of be helpful in that scenario. I don't see why a school would be purposefully obstructive, particularly if they're not really too familiar with it.
Cool. Well, I think that kind of brings us nicely onto your little fact for the week.
Yeah, it's time for me to tell you something new and interesting. So what I wanted to tell you about is something called the Pinocchio effect.
Okay.
And this is a reported effect that when people lie, their nose gets warmer. Yeah. And so, you know, it sort of sparked, certainly the researchers who are researching it, it sparked interest in terms of using that as a, well, just using sort of thermo imaging.
What kind of time, like temperatures are we talking?
So a couple degrees.
That's cool.
Like a degree or maybe two.
Okay.
I have some problems with the science behind it, though.
Okay.
The first problem is the samples are really small.
One.
Not that small, but still pretty small. Often in their experiments, sort of 10 and then 10 participants as a control. So it's very small numbers.
Probably get more people.
Oh, yeah. And I'm surprised that they didn't want to get more people. I don't know what the limiting factor was there. The paper came out a few years ago and it was pre-COVID. So, you know, that wasn't limiting things.
Hmm.
The interesting thing, though, is that they seem to have found that whilst your nose gets warmer when you're lying in person, it gets colder when you're lying on the phone. Which is, again, you know, either that's an interesting finding or it's just the fact that they've only used 10 participants. So it's just, you know, randomly varying anyway.
I mean, a degree feels like, well, I suppose it'd be interesting to look at what duration that change in temperature lasts.
It sticks around for, yeah.
Because if it's just a transient thing, then you know that's more telling than if it's just a long-term overall temperature. And how quick it is. So if it's like you tell a lie and then instantly your temperature changes versus like the room's getting warmer over an hour.
Yeah, so you know, I think there's potential there. There's promise. But I think so far the analysis into it was not happy with the scientific rigor that they had employed.
Have you written a letter of complaint?
Not yet, but I'm going to get in touch with the journal that published it, and I'll say, what on earth are you thinking? This needed more participants.
Yeah, interesting. My fact is a medical one, as you can probably imagine.
A medical one?
It's actually based on the nose as well.
Okay.
But a different type.
A different type of nose?
A different category of facts, right, I should have said.
Okay. That in itself would have been an amazing fact.
Yeah, we'll just end the show there. So have I told you about MHC molecules before?
MHC? It doesn't ring a bell. What does MHC stand for?
Can't actually remember now, but I learned this. Okay.
It's not important.
Yeah. Stop asking embarrassing questions, please. It was more than 10 years ago. Well, the interesting about this, essentially in our immune systems, we have antibodies, we have cells for the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system. And you'll often hear of them called things like B cells and T cells. For instance, and essentially a lot of these cells, what they rely on are something called MHC receptors.
Okay.
And the very long and short of it is that it takes a while for the cells to kind of essentially, in our body, there's hundreds and millions of these T cells, T lymphocytes and B lymphocytes. And what happens is, MHC receptors are essentially protein receptors. What they do is, on every single protein, there is a bit that will fit into a particular MHC receptor on a specific type of cell. So, for instance, let's say you eat something that has a nasty bacteria in it. That bacteria, one of the proteins in that bacteria, will fit nicely into one of the cells in your body. That's a T lymphocyte, which has a particular MHC receptor. And all the MHC receptors are completely different.
Okay.
And then when there's a fit, that sends a signal to the immune system saying, hey, we've got a match here. There's going to be more of this. And then that cell starts to multiply really quickly.
Yeah.
And then there's all the good stuff like releasing antibodies. I mean, it's a bit more complex now, but that's essentially it in a nutshell.
Hmm.
So it makes sense that you want, as a individual, you want as great a variety of MHC receptors or MHC type cells as possible, because let's say you only have 100 receptors, your chance of being able to detect a pathogen are quite low. Whereas if you have 100 million, your chances of being able to detect a pathogen are much, much higher.
Okay. Yeah. So more, I guess, more of the same kind of MHC, right?
So just different. So the more different receptors you have, the more you can detect things.
Okay, fine.
So essentially, the more receptors you have, the more things you can detect, and then you can fight against them.
Sure.
This is kind of like the principles of where immunity are thought to be. So this is potentially why they think that some people are more immune, in air quotes, than others, okay. Or more resistant to certain pathogens. And that all sounds very, very reasonable. But if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, it makes sense and it's beneficial to have a greater variety of these receptors. And there was a study a few years ago where they showed that actually partners who kind of, for instance, when people first meet, what they're doing is they're actually smelling each other's MHC receptors. And then that determines how much they like each other. So it was mine. I mean, it's, again, very relative. I haven't seen this paper for a long time now, but relatively small samples.
Yeah.
But really, really interesting findings. The idea was that if the couple have very different MHC receptors, then their progeny will have
both
essentially, yeah. And therefore greater variety versus a couple which have essentially identical MHC receptors.
Okay. Do you know how the people in the study sort of interacted? Were you just sort of presented together in a room and then you had to rate the person at the end?
I can't remember this now. But
okay.
Maybe we should do a journal club, shouldn't we, of all these?
Yeah, because, well, it would be difficult, right, to control for things.
Yeah.
Although I suppose the idea would be that you don't want to control for things because... ultimately, so I would have thought it's, you know, the way that the person looks plus the way that they sort of talk and behave and interact with you would be a better explainer of how much you like them.
Yeah.
But if that doesn't, that's very interesting.
Mm. Yeah.
It means I can stop bothering trying to be, you know, why bother with conversation? Just get yourself some nice smelling MHC and everyone will like you.
Or if you really like a girl or a guy and they don't like you back, just spray yourself with like different variants of MHC to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of, I suppose, like a pheromone kind of thing, right?
I can already see the adverts for a new cologne line, which is basically just, MHC. Wow.
Interesting, right?
Yeah. Not what I'd expect.
No. And when I first read this paper, I thought it was like mumbo jumbo.
Yeah.
So kind of when I remember writing this essay a long time ago in my pathology days. So I kind of just put like a little footnote and like towards the end, you know, like when you write a scientific essay, you kind of go through the facts, introduction, main body, and the conclusions put, perhaps there are other ways that MHCs can be smelt. And then my supervisor got really excited by this because he happened to like have read this paper and was like equally like, you know,
okay.
In it. So, I mean, it's not just one of like those pop science things. It's grounded, but very interesting.
Yeah, no, cool. Wow, how important are noses?
How important are noses? Yeah. It could be the windows to the soul to catch people lying.
Yeah,
and also to relationships. Maybe that's why Voldemort was really unhappy all the time.
Because, well, I think there were potentially other factors. But it could have been, you're right.
Like being split into eight things.
He couldn't work out if he liked anyone because he couldn't smell their
that's why no one liked him, because it couldn't.
Poor guy. Misunderstood.
Misunderstood, yeah. If only he had MHC cologne line.
So it would be great if your own cologne line was so potent that it stopped Wizarding Wars. Like, what a tagline.
Yeah.
I don't think you can, there's no better marketing than that, really.
Yeah, instead of magic is might, be like MHC is right.
All right, awesome.
All right, cheers. Well, have a good day. Catch you next week.
I'll see you next week.